So conservatives on Twitter follow a lot of liberals, but liberals only follow other liberals. And so they really are in like a little echo chamber. Like, I remember when Kamala Harris first came out the gate, I was on the horn with every Democrat I knew being like, please explain to me why you like her. Like, please tell me again. Tell me in different words. I have to understand.
Don't use Donald Trump.
Exactly. I couldn't grasp it because it was such a mystery to me. And I that's my job, is to understand that so I can at least try to convince them. How can I convince them if I don't even understand it? And I could not find it in myself. Like, usually I can imagine my way into like, and I just couldn't. So that you have to find people who are willing to upset their audiences. You know, I think the Free Press audience, they don't like me. I mean, every video they post to me is
you get a lot of negative comments.
Yeah. And it's
Barry,
like,
why are you letting her talk?
Exactly.
It's like, I think Barry wants her on there for a reason.
I love it because I'm like, to have an audience who disagrees with you is the most precious thing this business. But most people don't want that. They only want attaboys. They only want plaudits. Yep. They only want yas queen, like, you go girl. So you got to find people who like, exactly, who like, you know, have that character trait of, it's very difficult. I think it's very difficult for women, especially, who can't stand like being criticized. We just want to be told we're good looking all day, you know, like, it's like, that's it. I would say, like, if people want objective journalism, we are all biased, but, you know, look for someone who's willing to admit their biases. Like, I'm never going to not have a pro-America bias when I'm looking at a story. I just freaking love this country, and I will always see it as worth fighting for and through the best possible light. And that's my bias, and I'm always going to bring that to every story. And absent that, I'm trying to find the truth, and I'm willing to be unpopular. Let's go!
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to I Came with Fire podcast. Tonight, we are here with a very special guest, Batya Unger-Sargon. I would like you to introduce yourself, and then we'll just jump right in so that we can use up all this time we have.
My name is Batya Unger-Sargon. I am the opinion editor at Newsweek. I am the author of two books. The first is Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. And the second is called Second Class, How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. And both are really focused on how the real divide in America is the class divide rather than right versus left. Mm-hmm. And I am very, very deeply honored to be here. I don't know a lot about you guys except that you are heroes. You've served this country honorably and continue to do so in Chris's case. And I feel truly, truly humbled at your interest in my work and the fact that it spoke to you. It's just from the bottom of my heart, I'm so, so grateful for everything that you've given this nation and for being here.
Thank you.
Well, that means a lot. I appreciate it. And it's awesome to have your support, and your work was really good. I read both Second Class and Bad News. I think they're outstanding. I really enjoyed listening to people's stories in Second Class. I think the biggest takeaway, I think, for anybody who reads it is that we're all just people trying to make it through life, and that there are a lot of situations that are outside of your control and some that are inside of your control that kind of dictate what happens to you, right? So there's a level of accountability and then a classism and systemic thing that goes on there that can keep people where they're at when they don't want to be. So I'll just jump in here. You have the sort of unpopular position of being a critic in journalism, a critic of journalism in journalism, right?
I'm actually a big fan of that.
Me too. Yeah, because we poke fun at the military all the time because nothing is ever above reproach, right? But my first question for you, I think, I really want to state the goal of this conversation is to just kind of show that the left-leaning media isn't just a Trump-era conspiracy theory, that there is a deliberacy there, and then kind of go over what that is, and then how the media uses a classism and racism essentially to as a vehicle to make money off of people. And those are the goals I have, and those are definitely themes in your books. But if you could jump in on that with us and kind of give us some themes and things that you notice when you were writing these books and you put into your story.
Let's start with a very recent example that we all just witnessed, which was Donald Trump on the debate stage mentioning
that Haitians are eating cats.
right. And then being immediately fact-checked by these journalists being like, you know, Mr. President, nobody's eating any cats, right? You know, that looks like a story of, you know, a goofy president being met by, you know, an educated, responsible, you know, erudite, right, credentialed expert, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what that is, right? That is Donald Trump in his kind of blustery way trying to express the outrage of working class Americans whose futures have been sold out, first through NAFTA, you know, then by the defunding of vocational training, and then by the importing of just millions and millions and millions of replacement workers. And him sort of, I think in that instance badly, but he has the record to prove that he can do it well, giving voice to that outrage, which it is an outrage. Mm-hmm. And those experts, those journalists, they're not opposing him because they are on the left. I mean, at some level, sure, yes, those things are true. But the real thing that's going on there is they are calling him racist, implying he is racist, to mask the ways in which he is making an economic argument to uplift working class Americans and to shrink the divide between the non-credentialed working class Americans and people with a college degree like those journalists. Okay. So they belong to the class that has benefited from income inequality. They love to rail against the billionaires, right? It's like always the left is like the billionaires are the ones stealing the wages of the working class. That's nonsense. If you compare the 1970s to today, the share of the GDP that's controlled by the billionaire class, by the top 1%, has not changed significantly. So where has all the middle class gone? The middle class is disappearing, right?
Yeah.
The upper class wants you to believe it's disappearing into the billionaire class. It's not. It's disappearing into their pockets. The top 20% now controls over 50% of the GDP. So what happened was in the 70s, most of the GDP was in the middle class. So you had journalists and college professors who made kind of the same amount of money as welders and plumbers and factory workers and truckers, right? Everyone was kind of in the middle. And what these Democratic politicians did with things like NAFTA and defunding vocational training and opening the border was they squeezed working class people without a degree down into the lower classes, and they squeezed themselves up into the upper top 20% in what was a wage theft, right? And with immigration, it's the best example for how that happens, because effectively before, if you had two people who were college professors and they were each making $60,000 a year and they had to hire somebody to watch their kids, if the only person available was an American, they were going to have to pay them $50,000 a year to watch their kids. But what they did was they opened the border, right? Suddenly college professors are now making $150,000 a year, and they're paying a Haitian immigrant $20,000 a year to watch their kid. So what happened to that American, right? They got left out of the pie, right? Now maybe they're working at McDonald's for minimum wage, right? So it was this upward transfer of wealth from the working class to the experts, which includes the journalists. And so when they're opposed to immigration, they tell you, oh, we're opposed to immigration because we have big hearts. We're compassionate. We want to help all these suffering people. How could we, who are so wealthy, not help these people who are suffering so much? Now, they may really believe that about themselves. I think some do, some don't. But they wouldn't be that wrong if it wasn't literally putting money in their pockets. And so these journalists have been basically, through their university degrees, they have been taught how to mistake their own economic interests for some sort of morality, which allows them to paint the people Love standing that. Up for the working class as racists. So that was the argument that I laid out in Bad News. And we literally saw it happening on that stage. I was like, oh, this is what Bad News was about.
They just can't help themselves, really.
Yeah, I couldn't help, because I've been listening to your book all day to get ready for this conversation. And one very interesting anecdote that you pulled out was that, not that long ago, I think you quoted it as 2015, Senator Bernie Sanders is having Yeah, he's having an interview in which somebody asked him about open borders, and he basically absolutely was totally and completely against open borders. He said no nation state in the world could be for that. You laid out the word duty
and responsibility.
Yeah, you laid out the thesis that was almost completely and totally a libertarian or right leaning argument for that, and then in just the last 9 years, it's almost totally flipped to where it is a completely and totally left versus right issue. And the way that I see it is it's almost – you can almost take the economics out of it as far as the left is concerned, or at least this is what I am seeing, and that it's almost completely and totally a philosophical or a moral argument as far as they're concerned, whereas on the right, it is a – it's very much an economical argument. It is our way of life is disappearing. I can't feed my children. And this, I don't think that you can see this divide grow much wider without some type of significant event taking place. And I'll leave that back to you. I just wanted to provide some, because it's like, I did so much enjoy reading your book and hearing you talk about it. I'm like, oh, she said that in the book today. I read that. So I wanted to put an exclamation point on that for you.
I think that you just hit on the point, which is you have to have enormous amounts of privilege to see immigration through a racial lens, because it means that these people are not competing with you economically, right? And of course, that's true of journalists and college professors and anyone in the knowledge industry. Like, if you come across the border and you don't speak English and you don't have a credential, this is why they're obsessed with their credentials and where they went to university. Like, if you go to a party with journalists, all they're talking about is who went to what university. It's like, it's so horrible. It's so much worse than you imagine. There's so
like
much
military
worse.
Guys and what badges they have.
Right. That's really funny. And to your point, I just want to say really quickly, I have a few credentials that now Apple Wallet will let you put into your Apple Wallet, and then it can be evidence that you have this certification or credential. So it's a built-in function in your iPhone, and then from these institutions that give you these credentials, like for me, cybersecurity CompTIA, you can put it in your Apple Wallet and be like, look, I'm certified to do this. It's just kind of funny, to your point.
No, totally. Well, so, okay, so here's something that I want to ask you guys. So there was a video that was sort of circulating in the context of this, like, you know, Haitians eating cats story. I don't think any cats were actually consumed, you know, but what did happen was they plonked 20,000 people in a town of 60,000,
right,
where
helicopter
the median income is $27,000 a year, right? And so a lot of poor people, black and white, right, are suddenly now competing for resources with 20,000 people, a third of the town's size, who are not citizens. And there was a video that circulated. It was a factory owner. Did you guys see this? It was a factory owner. And this kind of story, I think, is very I've heard it a lot. He was saying, look, 10% of my workforce now is Haitian. I've got 30 Haitian guys working here, and I wish I had 30 more, because unlike the local guys, they're not on drugs, and they show up on time, and they stand by their thing, and they work hard, and they meet their things. Now, to me, that's exactly why you don't open your border, because of course, like, the ownership class wants slave labor, like people who can't demand better conditions, who can't demand breaks.
Can you really call it slave labor? Is that fair? I'm just wondering.
Well, they are sort of indentured,
because
right?
them that would constitute economic upward mobility for them.
No, you're right. Yeah, I shouldn't call it slave labor. I mean, a lot of them are slaves to the cartels, which is what I meant.
Because yes,
that's a good point.
Came here,
yes,
like,
that
they
is
owe
a good
the
point.
Cartels $10,000, $15,000, right. What have you? But the reason they're such good workers is because they are desperate, right? And to me, that's the argument against it. But I guess my question for you guys is, like, so, you know, there is a we do have a problem. Part of what happens when you invite in millions and millions of people to replace working class men, working class white men, but also other races, is you get this crisis in masculinity. You get a crisis, a spiritual crisis.
Mm-hmm. Where interesting. People, you're taking it there.
People can't show up to work on time. They can't. They, you know, the drug, the overdose epidemic, right? This is a spiritual crisis that I believe is the result of the economic crisis. But what do we do now? Like, what do we do with the fact that 7 million men are out of the workforce because they've been so downgraded in this country?
Yeah, a very unique take on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, first off, I could soapbox on this all day, and I can contextualize it through my experience in the military, okay? Because as a non-commissioned officer in charge of airmen, in my case, I see a lot of the 18 to 22-year-old crowd, which are the younger enlisted or could be college-age people, and they don't want to work. They have grown up very much in an environment where everything is provided for them. And the military is inherently a meritocracy wherein you have to prove that you're worth the time, essentially. And I see this and saw this so much where that erosion of those qualities in young people, and you can't convince me otherwise, I truly believe this is going on, to your point, don't want to participate in that meritocracy, and they want to find avenues around it. And so bureaucratically, the military has become this way of pushing that out. And then there are avenues for these guys to go around it. And then the middle class or the middle group, the NCO, the people who, like me and Chris, who came up a little bit older in the military, are now having to adapt to this new way of leadership. And it's kind of one of the reasons I got out, among other things. What do we do with everybody who is basically being disenfranchised by this? That's a great question. I wish I had a good answer for you. I think that there are a lot of things that we could do to train people how to do different jobs. I know that the military and veterans, specifically getting out of the military, they face this all the time. So there are a lot of resources for veterans. I think some of those resources could probably be retooled for people who are maybe looking to get out of the trucking industry to go into something else, or some sort of manufacturing job to go into something else, that they're really losing their positions to these things. But I don't have a good answer for you, unfortunately. I wish I did, Chris.
Yeah, man, there's so much that I want to say on this, but I'm gonna filter it down to the top 10%. One, Brandon, to your point, I think one of the things that we're seeing in the military, and this also bounces off of something, Batya, that you said in your book, Bad News, that the journalist, the job of a journalist is actually a trade, not necessarily a profession. And it's something that can only be learned. And the job of war is almost exclusively a trade. You can talk about strategy and stuff at the top, which we should have highly educated people that can look at the strategic level from 30,000 feet down and make those big moves. But the job of actually fighting a war is a trade, not a profession. Wow. And I know people are going to come at me about that because they call it the profession of arms, but I'm going to push back and I'm going to argue at you that that's something that started happening and filtering into our lexicon when they started trying to push for soldiers to go to college.
Because those are perishable and the junior
level officers to go to college. War is a trade, son. Like, you can only do it by training for it and going to it. But that's what Brandon and I did. We trained and we lead troops in the field. And then the second point that I wanted to make is on this is not all cultures are the same. And I'm saying that completely objectively, not that anyone is better than the other. They're just not the same. I've been to many third world nations in the world, and the same things that you're seeing in downtown San Francisco, maybe not necessarily the drug problem, but you would be hard pressed to look at like a small town in Syria and show me how it looks so much differently than what downtown, you know, Seattle looks like right now, with just, you know, military age men just sitting outside of their house all day, not going to work. There doesn't seem to be a lot of initiative there. There's no drive. There's no motivation to build. Culture is not advancing. In fact, it's only moving backward. And so for me, I feel like, and I'm going to pull this back to my experience as a non-commissioned officer, I feel like the thing that stands between us and moving backward is masculine men that teach young men to move up, to become leaders. And that is the gap that we're missing largely in the United States. And I'm going to say a thing, and I don't mean to offend you by it, but it's just my viewpoint on it. I believe that the United States has turned into a somewhat of a gynocracy, in which we're being led by females, and we have one that is running to be president of the United States right now, however you guys feel about that, but it's true. And you're looking at, and one of the things that I think you saw in that debate was you're looking at masculine type A driven male versus a just a a female leader. Like, that's what that looks like on stage together. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of people saw. And when you see that bounced off of each other, I think that's one of the reasons that people on the left look like it. And they're like, yes, slay queen. Like, she walked away from that, the winner. And people on the right, like more of the working class that resonate with the things that Donald Trump say, looked at the way that he got angry and he's mad about what's going on. And they're eating the dogs. They're eating the cats. And they're like, I understand what that guy's saying. Like, and that looks like leadership to me, right? And so I think to wrap all this up with a bow and to answer your question, it is masculine leaders are what we need. They're what we're missing. And if fathers started, you know, loving their wives, fathering their children, standing up in their small communities, getting on the school boards, and I'm talking about masculine men, and I don't mean it in the toxic sense, right? Like, whatever toxic masculinity is, don't get me off on that rabbit hole, but I mean actual.
I want to talk about
actual masculine men.
Let's do it.
Leading their communities, then it starts from the bottom up, and then we wouldn't have this problem. Yeah, I don't think we would have
that happen. How do we that? We're describing like a culture. I don't want to say cultural revolution because that's like
you're interviewing us now. She flipped.
I love
the script,
it. No,
man.
I want to hear the question.
She used her people.
So many people come on here and don't do this.
I'm so sick of hearing myself talk. No, I want to add to what you're saying about toxic masculinity, and then I want to hear your thoughts about how do we accomplish that. But the discourse around toxic masculinity, like that conversation, it's just prevalence in the culture, in your streaming, you know, whatever TV shows, whatever, what have you. In my view, it is not an accident that discourse started in the 90s, exactly around the time
Friends.
Of NAFTA.
Friends.
NAFTA.
Mm-hmm. Like exactly at the time that the Democrats decided it's okay to ship macho jobs that require physicality and brawn and give men the opportunity to be providers of their families, leaders in their families. At exactly the time that they were shipping those jobs overseas, they developed a language to justify it by saying, well, masculinity is toxic.
Sure,
well, mm-hmm. being a provider is evil. Wanting to be the head of a household and to protect your wife and protect your children is bad and is poisonous, right? This whole language was an alibi for the dispossession of the American man. That's how I
see
it.
And I'm gonna push back on that whole ideology since you want to hear my thoughts on it, and saying that I don't believe that there is a such thing as toxic masculinity. I believe that there is masculinity, there is femininity. I'm a very devout Christian man. I believe that, you know, two genders, God created man and he created woman. Where I come down on the entire theory of the responsibility of man to lead, and I do believe that it is a God-given responsibility to us as men, is in the New Testament where God said, you know, men, love your wives as Christ loved the church and be willing to lay down your life for her. So in the leadership role also comes an inherent responsibility that if there is to be a sacrifice for the family, for the good of the next generation, it is already on me. My life is forfeit the second that I took a wife and that I fathered children. My life is already forfeit for them. If there is to be a sacrifice, if somebody is to go hungry, if somebody is to work all day, all night, like if somebody's to not get Christmas gifts and, you know, birthday presents, it's me. Like, I took on that responsibility for, you know. And then the other side to complete the argument, women's respect your husbands, right? And like, that's why we have that leading role, because we're the ones that are expected to sacrifice our lives for the family, right? And so that's where my idea of masculinity comes from. And then when you understand that it comes from a place of sacrifice, not from a place of I'm in charge because I said so and it's what I say goes, get in your bedroom, like that's not what it is. It's I view everything that I do for my family through the lens of I love you and I care about your well-being more than I care about, this is specifically to my children, but sometimes to my wife too. I care about what's best for you more than I care about if you like me right now. because I want to do what is best for you and is going to bring you joy and fulfillment in your life. And I think that that's how men should lead and provide for their families. And then if you take that and you multiply that by every level of leadership that men find themselves in, if it's your community and you're the mayor, I love this town and I took an oath to defend the Constitution and lead this town. And I care what's best for this community above and beyond whether or not I care about the, if this community likes me, and I'm going to do what's best for this community, even if I'm the one that has to sacrifice for it. If you take that continually, if you continually apply that up the chain, then that's why I think that masculinity is the key to the lock that you're seeking.
So personally, how do you bring that back to this culture that's lost it?
Well, if I could try answering your question too, I have some ideas and I just want to expand because I like bringing a lot of history and context to these things. I think that every culture and civilization all the way back that we can track, their erosion is tied very much to the eradication of their working class. Happened with the Romans, all the slaves that the Romans brought in, they watch all of these tradesmen, which is really what it was, is a lot of tradesmen lose their positions, labor went away. And even the military started to see it when the emperor started letting the barbarians into the Roman military, when all of that shift began to happen from the patrician class down and trickling into the other things, right? So I want to say that the erosion of our middle class, I think, is 100% going to be tied to when we discuss the death, if anybody ever discusses the death of the American empire, eventually it will be there. And the middle class is very much held up by men. And these positions are held by men, these working jobs for the most part, trucking, manufacturing, industry positions. It's all men. And I think it ties back into what Chris was saying very specifically, is that it's all child rearing. And I think that we've lost a lot of people. I think that there are generations of kids that have come up not understanding that. And then there are men who are now men who are raised as boys and teenagers to think that the qualities that they have that are natural to them and inherent to them are bad. Mm-hmm. And I see it often. And I would see it in the men, the 18 to 19 year old men who came into the military. Wow. And they're afraid to almost even exercise some of these abilities and ideas that they have. And then honestly, watching the military strike down some of those things in favor of the female or whatever in the group here. And I could give you examples, but
examples. I want to hear.
Sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, and I'm probably getting into some tropes here a little bit, and there are some blurred lines between like
there
what happened
to
the Air Force. And
if they weren't true, if you didn't see actual examples of them.
Sure. And what I also mean too is some of this is their stories too as well, right? So we all have to take them with a little bit of grain of salt. But things that I've seen specifically, and then Chris can attest to this too, women tend to very often get out of things in the military by virtue of just being a woman. And we see this a lot.
We're going
Oh, we are. I mean, she asked a question, right? So I'm going to give you the answer from my perspective. And this is not just my perspective. It's a shared perspective. It's something that we talk about and would talk about often. And obviously, there's some people who take it too far in the military and they come up with some things to say that are inappropriate or whatever. But it is very much an observable thing. This goes into any of these services like the police force, the fire department, EMTs, things like that, where there's a concern about it. And then I have seen women get selected for things specifically because they are a woman, whether the guy in the situation, let's just talk about maybe getting hired to work in a back office job where they don't have to be out and about anymore, right? Is they're going to take the girl, we're going to take her. And we want her because she's going to be this person, this face for this or whatever, even though the guy has these qualities that were actually on the job description, but we're going to take her because she's a female. And I've seen a lot more of that happen, and a lot more of it happen, not just in the gender way, but also in a racial way, as basically nearing the time I got out of the military. But to my point, I want to say that I think that we've lost a lot of generation of men. It's going to take some real work on their behalf of the young adults now to fix some of these issues and understand and then see outwardly the media not vilifying them for having the qualities that they inherently have. Because if you're 22 years old or older, you know, your parents aren't involved in your life and in raising you the way. So it's going to take men today with small children, raising them, and specifically men, right, to raise them that way. Do they understand that, you know, this burden really does fall on you? And it's not necessarily a burden. maybe that's not the right word, but it's your yoke to carry. Mm-hmm. And that it's that responsibility is a privilege, because you get the opportunity to take care of a family. You get the opportunity to provide for people, and you get the opportunity to put your community and your country on your back and then take it forward. And these aren't things to sneer at. These are things that, I mean, it's not even inherent to just America. These are qualities. If you read anybody throughout history, they talk about men and these things and the nobility of men. You know, if the Spartans come back with your shield or on it, like, it's just all of these things about men in general, and doing these things. So I think that masculinity is a big piece of missing, like what Chris was saying. And to answer your question very specifically, it's going to take a lot in the home and parenting, I think, to sort of bring that back, because I think we've lost a generation.
To put a how-to on it, Batya, I'm going to quote my wife, and she puts it like this. She says, if you treat a man like a boy, he's going to act like a boy. But if you treat a boy like a man, he will become a man. And if you see that in the military, the way that I've seen it work, you take young men, you put them in like Ranger school is a great example. And then you say, hey, you young PFC, private first class, you've never led people before. This is a leadership school in the Army, the premier leadership school. And we keep them up for 20 hours a day. We march them, you know, 16 miles a day with 85 to 100 pound rucksacks. And then we put them on an objective at 2 o'clock in the morning. We say, lead these tired, hungry, cold dudes and do this objective. And it's some young 18-year-old PFC that's never done it before. But in that crucible where you force a young man, a young boy into a leadership position, the whole point of that school is, can he rise to the occasion and find that inside of him to be a leader, to marshal his dudes and get the objective done? Or can he not? And if he does, he gets the tab. He gets the badge. You did this. You went there. You did it. And he has a thing to show for it for the rest of his life. I think that's very important. Like, attaboys are huge in male psychology. And if he can't, then he fails and he doesn't get it. And he has to go back and either try again or he gives up and he goes away. And so, you know, there's a certain amount of, like, I know ladies are going to be like, oh, that's so sad. He doesn't get another choice. He doesn't get another chance. It's like, no. You're talking about, to your point, how to do this. No, like, meritocracy and masculinity is the way, the crucible, the young warrior going through the fire and either rising to the challenge or not is the point. And then these are the men that work their way by the sweat of their brow, right? That work their way up into the next ranks and then are allowed to lead men moving forward. And then the ones that don't make it, hey, get in the back of the formation. Like, you still have to listen to people. You haven't proven yourself yet. And so it is a system that works, and people don't like it because it's exclusive, but it's exclusive on purpose, because we're looking for the people that have the ability to do the job or don't. And it used to just be inherent in society. And this actually comes back to a question that I actually had for you about that, because we talk about the top 20% having 50% of the GDP. People think that that's inherently bad. And I know in the journalistic class, it's like people look at that and they go, well, then that shows that there's inequality. And then now the new buzzword is inequity. There's inequities, that's a Bible term, inequity built into the system because some people don't achieve and some people do. I understand that there's fundamental unfairness in society. I think that that's a result of just being human beings and living on this rock together, right? I'm not 6'5" and black. I'm never going to play in the NBA. It's just not in the cards for me, right? But would you call that an inequity? Right? Because it's like, where does personal choice and merit work into that larger worldview of the inequity of the system? Do you think there's a place for that in that worldview or not?
Do you know, no one has asked me that question before, and it's a very important question. The whole premise of my book is like, working class people want to work. Like, they don't want to be handed
right.
things. Like, they believe in meritocracy.
I believe you said there's an inherent dignity in charging. You were talking about Ben Day in your first book that I was reading today, and charging people a penny for the paper. But because he charged a poor person a penny, they felt more dignified because, you know what, I worked hard for this, but I will give it to you because you're giving me a product that I like. And now I feel more dignified for having been included and being able to contribute. Right. And I think that's very, it's the whole teach a man to fish versus giving him a fish kind of thing. But I am very interested in your, and your take on it. Is there a place for
that line? Thank you for reminding me of that. My answer would be, I don't have a problem with there being rich people and poor people, billionaires, millionaires. In fact, working class people, as you guys know, are remarkably free of resentment against billionaires. Like, they kind of admire them and see them often as jobs creators, and they would like to be like them. My problem is that the Democrats created policy that took money from the middle class and from jobs we rely on to survive, and made those jobs pay shit by bringing in the 1970s. So 1971 was the high watermark for working class wages for people who work in jobs that don't require a college degree. The percentage of the country that was foreign born, meaning that was an immigrant, was 4%. Today it is 15%, which is the highest it has ever been. It's higher now than in the Gilded Age, which was 14%, which was the most unequual time in American history. My problem is not that there's inequality. My problem is that under the guise of compassion, the Democrats sold out the people who work the hardest in this country. They took their wages and gave them to their cronies who go to their universities, because universities are Democrat factory machines, right? So Obama took all this money that used to go to vocational training and put it into Pell Grants and other college stuff, so everyone would have to go to college. And like, that's my problem. It's not that there's inequality. Mm-hmm. It's that the people who work the hardest, who used to make a decent living, right, who all they want is the most modest version of the American dream, you know, support my family in dignity, be able to retire, a vacation once in a while, adequate health care. And they made that only possible for people who have this meaningless credential because they spent 4 years learning woke crap. Right. Mm-hmm. And are able to, like Kamala Harris, recite by rote the memorized, you know, factory settings, Democrat positions. Right. Because they're able to reflect the desires of their corporate overlords while pretending to be the heroes on the side of the little guy. That's my problem. It's not that they're richer. It's that they're garbage, and they engineered an entire economy to make themselves rich at the expense of the working class, like in the name of social justice. Like, that's the thing that I can't say about it, is the dishonesty. Like, I hate them so much more than I hate the Chamber of Commerce, like free market, free trade crap, you know, the old school, the Mitch McConnell version of the Republican Party. But at least they never lied about it. You know, they were like, yeah, we're the party of the rich. Get over it. Right. But it's like, for them to act like they're the party of the working class or the middle class, while effectively representing the rich and then the very poor, people who don't want to work and who won't work and who can't work and who. Right. It's like that combination that I find really offensive.
It reminds me of another part from your book where you said that white liberals don't actually want to fix the problem. They just ask for a more diverse elite caste. And that's, I think, perfectly summed it up, because they don't actually have to fix the problem. They don't have to remove themselves from their white tower. They get to essentially pretend like they care, all the while maintaining the power that they still have, because it's just a mask and it's not actually trying to solve the problem anymore. You know, and obviously people recognize that, and it's almost like they're blind to it, and people are sick and tired of it, I think.
It reminds me, have you guys ever seen a movie called The Cheyenne Social Club? It's an old school Western film. It's Jimmy Stewart, Henry Fonda. Jimmy Stewart, they're both cowboys out in the West, and Jimmy Stewart gets a telegram from his uncle, recently deceased, in Cheyenne, Wyoming. So he rides up there, and all he knows is that his uncle worked a hotel. And so he goes up and he gets the deed to the hotel, and he becomes, you know, the proprietor. And he goes in and he realizes very quickly that it was a brothel that his uncle was running. And so as this is dawning on him, and all these ladies now they work there and they're like, well, we hope you're going to keep us on. And he's like, well, why would I fire any of you? Not realizing that they're prostitutes. But it was a very, very high end social club because it catered to the lawyers and the doctor and the mayor of the town and whatnot. But there's a scene in there where Jimmy Stewart goes into town, and now that he's got this and he left him quite a substantial fortune, he goes in, he gets his first ever tailored suit. He just came off the range. He's been a cowboy his entire life. And he's walking back over to the social club with his buddy, Henry Fonda. And he goes, you know, I think I'm not going to do my Jimmy Stewart impression, but he's like, you know, John, I think I'm going to have to start voting Republican. And this is the joke of the scene. He goes, I think I'm going to have to start voting Republican. Are you going to be okay with that? And his buddy, who's just been hanging out the whole time, just because he doesn't have anything else to do, he goes, well, John, as long as you're okay, if I still vote Democrat, he goes, well, why would I care about that? And he goes, well, I've just noticed that people that vote Republican don't tend to like people that vote Democrat. But it's just such an interesting scene if you guys go back and watch that film, because it so encapsulates everything that you guys were just talking about, that this guy goes from being of the lowest class of society up to a proprietor of a hotel and working with the high-end social elite. And then all of a sudden, like, he's trying to find himself again. And if you guys have never seen it, go back and watch it. It's a great study, and actually, Bhatia, I'm really surprised you've never seen it, because everything that you're writing in your books is like in that movie.
Totally,
like,
no, and I love Jimmy Stewart. I thought I'd seen all his movies, so I'm gonna go watch that. Sounds great.
That's a great one, The Cheyenne Social Club. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, well, I know you. We got about maybe 10 more minutes with you, so I'm gonna kind of shift gears a little bit. And I really would like to get your opinion, because a point that Chris and I make pretty often is we feel like the U.S. is not that far behind Europe and some of the authoritarianism that they are experiencing over there, especially in the U.K. I just would like to get your opinion on what's going on in the U.K. with Keir Starmer, and then say, too, that you were on Will Kingston's podcast not that long ago, Fire at Will. Really good podcast. We had Will on our last episode and talked to him, but he used the words for his brand of authoritarianism as a boring technocratic managerialism. And he basically said he was like a Puritanism form of authoritarianism. Just curious what you thought on the way he described that, because I thought it was pretty genius. And then what your thoughts on what are going on there versus the potential that the United States might be heading down that same road.
Okay. So my answer to this, people don't like it, but I can only say what I think is true. And I'm going to preface this by saying my view of the United States is deeply informed by the fact that I'm Jewish. I'm an Orthodox Jew. I'm observant.
Couldn't tell.
To me, America is, among other things, of course, the only country in the history of humanity that organized its branch of Christianity around the protection of Jews rather than attacking and oppressing Jews from the inception.
For sure.
First American Protestants and then followed by American Catholics in 1967. We Jews call this the Golden Medina, which means the golden country. We've always called it that. As Jews, there has never in the history of humanity been a population that decided to organize its religion around protecting us. And to me, that has given me a window into the heart and soul of America, the beating heart of America. And I think it gives me a vantage point with which to see the exceptionalism of this country that I can't. I always come back to that. Now, of course, I think I'm being objective when I'm analyzing things like authoritarianism, but I just have to preface it by saying, like, I will always bring the benefit of the doubt to this country. I will always see it in the best possible light. That is in my veins. It is in my bones. I feel so tightly knit into the fabric of this country. And I would go down fighting for this country, not in the way that you guys already have, but, you know, in any way that I possibly could out of gratitude. And I honestly, when I look at this question of authoritarianism, I don't think we are in the same camp. And I don't think it's just because the First Amendment, but of course we have a First Amendment. And even though our young people have pretty much given up on free speech, like, they just don't like it. Like, they're just not that into it. You poll people, like, you know, 18 to 24, they're like, who needs it, right? It's like, you know what? like suckers, like, sorry, scary. Like, you're stuck with it. You're going to have to grow up. You're going to get a mortgage one day and then exactly. You're going to become a Republican.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I love it.
So we have the First Amendment. We have the Republican Party, which, you know, is, you know, it's so interesting now that conservatives are the side of free speech. But even I'll give you an example, and I'm curious what you guys make of this. This may be totally Pollyannish, but I look even at like what Mark Zuckerberg did, right? Mm-hmm. What he did was unforgivable. The FBI and the government came to him and said, censor this stuff for us. And he said, no problem, right? I mean, they were mm-hmm. all doing it, right?
All the cool
the
kids.
The Supreme Court case hung on the fact that he did still have the ability to say, no, I will not do that. Now, he did not rise to that occasion. There are mm-hmm. implied threats because Facebook relies on the largesse of Congress, the largesse of the law to protect it, right? So there's this sort of implied, well, do you want to see what happens if you don't do what we want? But we didn't actually get there because he complied so quickly. And so we mm-hmm. don't actually know what would have happened. It is my view that if he had said, actually, no, that's not right, I'm not going to do that, they may have tried a few things. But at the end of the day, if he had stood by, you know, the values, I guess he didn't have.
If he would have been masculine, is that what you're
trying
to say?
If he would have been a man about it, this would have gone to the Supreme Court and he would have won. And so to me, I feel like what was absent there was a question of character rather than like, you know, this technocratic authoritarianism. It's the FBI's job to try to, you know what I mean? To try to like screw with our rights. And it is our job as Americans and the law's job to protect us from that. And I feel that on balance, we are still just so far ahead of Europe, which they don't have a First Amendment. They don't have free speech rights. They don't think they need them. They think that hate speech should be illegal. So I still feel like this is the greatest country on earth and no one comes close. And I don't feel that we're, yes, there are many people who want us headed in the wrong direction, including this Tim Walz character who doesn't believe in free speech, right? Yes, those people are there. But I think if Donald Trump has proven anything, it is how resilient our institutions are. And I just get so much pride and joy out of that. I mean, you look at the Republican primary. I was just euphoric, and not because it was him who won, but because Nikki Haley outspent him 2-1. And if you
I've heard you make this point before.
That he would have, you could outspend someone 2-1 and still lose so embarrassing.
Well, and look at who her donors were too. That's right. Another totally. Very interesting point on that.
Totally.
One,
yeah. And he was like, I don't need your money. I'm going to win because the will of the people, because this is America and the will of the people decides. And that's exactly what happened. So I feel pretty good about the state of our democracy, but maybe that's Pollyannish.
No, I think that's really good. Is there time for one more question
for you?
Because I know you got to run. Yeah. And I desperately wanted to bring this up because you started with it and I wanted to circle back around with it. I wanted to talk just a second about the debate that happened the other night because you had a very interesting take on this. And I do want to extol you a little bit. I've been following you on social media now for a couple weeks in preparation to getting to talk to you. And you have routinely surprised me with your takes on things, which we've been almost diametrically opposed, almost. But I have found about you that you are not a person that is afraid of having a dissenting opinion. And I really appreciate that about you. So in looking at the debate, and I'm taking this from your the notes that I took on your book, Bad News, you said if you look at and the note that I wrote down is you called it the liberal alienation of the media, wherein like over 85% of the journalistic class is from a crescent that starts in New York and goes to D.C. and then from Los Angeles and goes to Silicon Valley. And these people are just basically talking back and forth to themselves. And then on that, you also said the takes of the right-wing media on looking at them are not necessarily misplaced because it seems to be true that there is an echo chamber there. However, I would say there's also a giant echo chamber on the right side of the media too. I think we can all agree on that. So understanding that and drawing those notes from your book, we come out of the debate, everybody says Kamala won, or at least the mainstream media, Kamala won, she's brat, look at this, you know, like, and Twitter, my Twitter feed is just blown up with it, which I'm going to try and I want to frame this question. Looking at what they're saying about it, And then a lot of the people in the right-wing media or the, like the populist class are saying, no, look at the Donald Trump won on the facts. Like, he absolutely presented his case better, even though he got sidetracked a few times. Seeing the divide that we have in the media, do you think, and debates are inherently subjective in how they're scored anyway, do you think, based on the analysis that you're seeing, that there is any possible way for the media to provide any type of actual objectionable analysis on things like this going into the future? Or do you think it is all just giant confirmation bias? Like, my wife likes to say, all media is propaganda, just pick your flavor. Mm-hmm. Like, do you think that there is actual objectionable analysis to be found in the media on things like this moving forward?
So first of all, your wife sounds like a very wise woman.
She's much wiser than myself.
What I would say is the media that I get the most out of is hearing people debate and disagree. So, for example, the show The Five on Fox News every day at five. Okay. I watch that every day because they have a Democrat on. It's usually Jessica Tarlov. I don't agree with her about anything, but I just love to hear her. And she's quite brave because it's four conservatives against her and she takes them on. And that's
Fox
where
News
you're going to
see.
Right, right. Totally. But, you know, we have a show now at the Free Press where there's four of us. We disagree. And, you know, that's your best bet for, to me. At Newsweek, we have a daily debate every single day at the top of the homepage. You'll have people from opposite sides. Because are we going to get to a situation where CNN is objective again? No. Are we going to get to a situation where, like, you can trust the New York Times? No, I don't think so. But what you can do is, and the problem with the YouTube shows, with the like independent media universe, is that their audience, they get audience captured because all of their revenue comes from the audience. Yep.
Can I jump on that for a second?
Yeah.
Yeah, because of what you just said, Brandon, and I meant to add that in my contextualization of the question. When you talk about like the audience capture and the advertisers and everything that goes into this entire business, there is no incentive, whether monetary or,
the opposite is quite the point, actually.
Yeah.
Right. It's like we only have an incentive to tell the audience that we're talking to what they want to hear. Exactly. Otherwise, they won't clip, they won't click, they won't come back. The advertisers don't want to be there because they're not there. So, and that's why I wanted to ask you this question, because if we're going to get back to a place of being able to have honest and fair debate, like, what's the outlet for that? Is it just Twitter? Do we all just yell past each other forever now?
It's really tough because also conservatives on Twitter follow a lot of liberals, but liberals only follow other liberals. And so they really are in like a little echo chamber. Like, I remember when Kamala Harris first came out the gate, I was on the horn with every Democrat I knew being like, please explain to me why you like her. Like, please tell me again. Tell me different words.
Don't use Donald Trump.
I couldn't grasp it because it was such a mystery to me. And I that's my job, is to understand that so I can at least try to convince them. How can I convince them if I don't even understand it? And I could not find it in myself. Like, usually I can imagine my way into like, and I just couldn't. So that you have to find people who are willing to upset their audiences. You know, I think the Free Press audience, they don't like me. I mean, every video they post of me is
I see. You get a lot of negative comments. Yeah. And Barry, like, why are you letting her talk?
Exactly.
It's like, I think Barry wants her on there for a reason.
I love it because I'm like, to have an audience who disagrees with you is the most precious thing this business. But most people don't want that. They only want attaboys. They only want plaudits. Yeah. They only want yas queen. Like, you go, girl. So you got to find people who have that character trait of, it's very difficult. I think it's very difficult for women, especially, who can't stand like being criticized. We just want to be told we're good looking all day, you know, like, it's like, that's it. That's the key, you know, but you know, it's,
well,
that,
you
that's
are.
My wife said to me on day one.
Yeah.
The advice.
It's funny.
Hannah tells me every day, she goes, just tell me I'm pretty. And buy me flowers. And I'm like, well, I can do that. Because she is.
Yeah. So I think that's what you're looking for. I would say, like, if people want objective journalism, we are all biased, but, you know, look for someone who's willing to admit their biases. Like, I'm never going to not have a pro-America bias when I'm looking at a story. I just freaking love this country, and I will always see it as worth fighting for and through the best possible light. And that's my bias. And I'm always going to bring that to every story. And absent that, I'm trying to find the truth, and I'm willing to be unpopular. And, like, that's really what you're looking for in a media character, someone who's, like, just willing to be unpopular. Like, I do not get invited to parties, guys. And, like, that's okay with me. Like, I'm active in my synagogue. Like, it's fine with me. But if
we had a party, we'd invite
journalists
you.
Like me, they don't like me, you know, like I,
you are invited to the first I Came With Fire podcast party.
That's right. Yes.
Guaranteed.
Guest of honor.
Well, listen, you guys, this has been incredible. Thank you so much. Thank you for your service. God bless you guys and for everything that you've done and your families and everybody that you love.
Yes. No, thank you so much for coming on. It was awesome getting to talk to you. Hopefully we get to again. It was nice. And thank you everybody for listening. Have a good night.